We live in an age now where everything is politics. And even if it isn't on the course, you go into the locker room and someone's saying something and I'm with you. It has no place on the course, off the course. Once you come in that gate, whatever it is, whether it's your local muni, you know, or the country club in Brookline, you know, to me, you should leave your politics at the door.
Welcome back to the Golfers Journal podcast, presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. My name's Tom Coyne. Thanks for listening, everyone. We are really excited about this podcast, and I was thrilled that our guest today was able to give us some time. Now, there's been a lot of talk about, obviously, the LIV Tour, sports washing, Saudi Arabia, MBS, all those things. And rather than leave it up to these very awkward press conferences and professional golfers to be the spokesperson on such topics, we went to one of the leading sources on all things Middle East, a winner of 3 Pulitzer Prizes, author, columnist, and perhaps most importantly for our purposes, a very dedicated golfer, Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, and of any number of TV outlets wherever you've seen him on TV, and I assure you that you have. He is the authority on the Middle East, also a member of Congressional and Seminole, too. So what a perfect mix for someone to talk to about LIV and Saudi Arabia and his golf life. It's almost as interesting as the life that he's lived covering politics and conflict in the Middle East. He's caddied in a U.S. Open. He's played around the world, literally, in places that you probably didn't even know you could golf. We're going to talk about some of those. We're really thrilled he gave us some time during a very busy time for a political commentator to talk golf and live and really to talk about life as well. Now, as always, we can bring you this podcast thanks to our subscribers. We hope you're enjoying number 20. I know I always say that the most recent one is our best one yet. And maybe it's recency bias, but I do mean it, I swear. And 20 is, I love 20. I hope you're enjoying it as well. A big welcome to anyone if 20 is the first edition that you're receiving. A lot of new Broken Tee Society members joining us, coming in on board after Father's Day. So it's great to have you, and let me take the chance to remind you that access to a robust event schedule is a big part of that Golfers Journal membership. And our marquee event will be opening soon for registration, our Broken Tee 2-Man. If you've been following us on social media, you've seen the video with Scotty Cameron engraving it himself. Scotty made the trophy. He puts the names on it every year. I'm contractually obligated to note that, yes, my name is on there. Shout out to my partner, Joel. I'm not contractually obligated to tell you that Two Man is an absolute blast. It is, and this year we're having it one of the great Golden Age East Coast golf courses. Tillinghast's Baltimore Country Club. Registration, it opens July 20th. So get your partner and get ready, or sign up on your own and we'll give you a partner. It is always the highlight of the golf season for me. So hope to see you there. Today's podcast also brought to you by Titleist. A lot of buzz about the new driver and, of course, the new irons and the new wedges, the new Vokey SM9s. But to enjoy them all properly, you have to get a fitting. Nothing will do more to improve your overall game more quickly than getting fit by an authorized Titleist fitting specialist. With a whole library of shafts to consider, a new premium partnership with Graphite Design, they have all the tools to get your game dialed. So visit Titleist.com to learn more and schedule a driver, iron, or wedge fitting today. Thanks also to our sponsors from the pages of the Golfers Journal. There's Scotty Cameron, Link Soul, Titleist, Oakley, Links and Kings, Charles Schwab, and FootJoy. And now, time to talk about what this LIV Tour is really all about, beyond the dollars and the days off, and to try to understand what Saudi Arabia could possibly be getting out of all of this. Tell us, what is the Saudi Public Investment Fund?
Well, the Saudi Public Investment Fund is a sovereign fund that takes all the oil wealth of Saudi Arabia that's not used on daily budgets and invests it for future generations, for current generations. So it has massive amounts of resources. I don't know what the current number is, but billions and billions of dollars. Which it uses both currently to build infrastructure and in the future, and to make investments for the future, whether it's in the entertainment realm or in the, you know, electrification or solar or highways and hospitals. That's what it is.
Okay. And what other ventures, I mean, they've used it for other things. This isn't the first time that they've used it for sports, is it?
No. They brought Formula One to Saudi Arabia. That's very popular in the Gulf. And they're looking, they use it to bring entertainment and entertainers, singers and performers and movie theaters and all forms of entertainment. I'm sure football and soccer, you know, I don't know which foreign teams, but they also have domestic league. But it's doing everything it can to make Saudi Arabia the fund to make it more tourism friendly, because it sees tourism as a huge future industry for Saudi Arabia.
Does it really? Where are they counting on tourists, do you think, to come from?
Oh, you know, they have a huge potential for tourism, for desert tourism. They've got vast coastlines and huge beaches. These places will be isolated from the general population. I mean, you know, it's not like they're going to be walking down into mosques or whatever, you know. But the country's also opening up to, women are in the workforce now in large numbers, in some ways more than men. They say women can drive. You can see boys and girls holding hands. It's been a huge change there over the last 10 years. And I'm not the Chamber of Commerce. I'm just telling you, it's not.
No, I understand. It's
not what it's all about.
No, for sure. And that's what's interesting to me about this whole thing. You know, growing up during Desert Storm and Saudi Arabia being, you know, and that was an ally, and you know, we had bases there and et cetera. And then Saudi Arabia is the bad guy and going back and forth. What is Saudi Arabia to us? It seems pretty complicated.
It is complicated. You know, it's been a long time ally in terms of providing energy for the West to grow, going back to World War II. And at the same time, it's been a source of the most virulent, puritanical Muslim ideology that fueled 9/11. So it's been both. Yeah. The regime is definitely more moderate than the people. But at times it's been afraid of the people, and at times it's given in to some of the worst extremes. It's funded, Saudi schools with the most austere form of Islam throughout the region. But MBS, before he did this terrible thing of killing Khashoggi, and to some degree since, has gone out of his way, sees it as his mission to open up Saudi Arabia and change those culture and religious norms.
And sports washing is a word we've been hearing a lot about. What is sports washing? How does that fit into what MBS might want?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on that, but I mean, it's the idea of Qatar, for instance, you know, is not exactly a liberal bastion, is hosting the World Cup. Built a set, a whole collection of stadiums, to soccer stadiums, just for this purpose of basically hosting a 2-week tournament, you know, of the World Cup. And it's certainly to rebrand itself. You know, Russia hosted the Olympics, China hosted the Olympics. You know, this is, look at us, you know, we can host downhill skiing, pay no attention over there to that, barbed wire fence, holding those Uyghurs back. So, it's a pretty old, Hitler hosted the Olympics too. So it's one of the older tricks in the book. I don't think it ever really works the way that people think it will, but there you have it.
If LIV is considered sports washing, it seems to me that it's actually drawing more attention to the human rights violations in Saudi Arabia. I mean, Saudi Arabia wasn't in the news, and now it's in the news all the time, being highlighted for the things that it wouldn't want to be highlighting.
That was my message. I mean, so far, let's say LIV has spent $1 billion in all the, or at least on paper, you know, and all the people they've induced to come, some of these 100 million that we read about, 200 million. They probably spent about $1 billion taking the Khashoggi story from the news pages to the sports pages. Yeah. That's actually a trick, you know, getting people to connect them again with 9/11. So I think it's been a colossal failure as an effort to improve their image. What I've told Saudi friends of mine, if you want to bring golf to Saudi Arabia, like you brought Formula One, that's fine. They already have a tournament. And if you want to bring golf tourists, hire the 5 best golf architects in the world if they'll come work for you, and have them identify 5 beautiful coastal sites and have them build the 5 greatest golf courses in the world. That's how you get tourism. But this is not how you get golf in Saudi Arabia. This is like not much different than hiring Steph Curry and LeBron James and giving them both $250 million to play horse in in 10 cities in Europe. This is not a business model, what they've done. There's no way they'll earn back from the LIV Tour $1 billion or $2 billion. So therefore, it's a branding exercise. And if it's a branding exercise, it's just a terrible waste of money because they haven't bought a better image for themselves. So I think the whole thing is, it seems to be just, you know, funding Greg Norman's, fight with the PGA Tour.
Indeed it is. Do you think it lasts? Do you think Saudi Arabia finally says, hey, we're not getting, like,
good,
like,
question,
you said,
Tom. It's a good question. I don't know. You know, it'll be hard for them to admit failure, you know, I think, when you spent all that money. But I don't really know. It's not a product. I guys need to make money. Guys are at the end of their lives on the tour, you know, their professional lives. I'm not here to pass judgment on other people. I just, as a golf lover and a golf follower and a golf addict and a golf enthusiast, it's not a product I care to watch. Not because it's necessarily or entirely because it's about Saudi Arabia, but because the whole thing is inorganic. It's completely contrived. It's a exhibition. And if a golf exhibition comes to my neighborhood over here at Bethesda Country Club, I might walk over and watch it, you know, if there are some big name players, but it's nothing I would be like going out of my way to follow. It's like watching a pro-am.
And do you think, you know, the pros that are going up on the dais now at these press conferences and having to answer these questions about human rights issues and political issues, and maybe not handling them particularly well, or maybe not being informed, or maybe just reading from a script. Do you feel that there's a culpability there that, or because, you know, Saudi Arabia better than most of us would. And if they offered you or me $100 million to go over and do what we did, it's complicated, like we were saying before, because, you know, then they'll say, well, if you like Nike, or if you, you know, if you're part of the global economy at all, you have to deal with Saudi Arabia. So maybe should we take it easy on these guys, or are they getting what they deserve?
There's a lot of truth to that. I'm not here to make that judgment. The way I look at it is that I care about the game of golf. I care about professional golf. I care about its traditions. I care about its connection to communities. I care about the charities that it supports, the way it brings people together. And I'm less personally judgmental than I am sad. I'm not here to tell somebody, look, the tour was in China. You know, I mean, it's there was a tour stop in China. You don't know about somebody that they've abducted or whatever, but trust me, there are plenty of them, you know? They played it. They used to, you remember the Sun City with South Africa, you know, there used to be that tournament, you know, there was controversy around that. I just find it, when I think of the Pro Tour as a fan, I think of both the PGA Tour, I think of the Champions Tour, I think of the Korn Ferry Tour, I think of the retirement program they have. It's a big ecosystem that supports a lot of people, a lot of communities, and a lot of golfers. And I just find it sad. I'd find it sad if the NBA disintegrated before my eyes, that this could unravel, you know, the whole framework of something I follow and have followed all my life as a fan. I would never do this if I were them. I would counsel people not to do it. But do I understand if someone waved $100 million in front of someone, that some people would do it? Yeah, of course I understand that. And that's their choice. I go to Saudi Arabia. I've written a lot about MBS. I don't boycott the country. I believe, you know, he is engaged in a process of reform that's very important. As I said in my column to him, because it was addressed to him, you're doing something very important here. But the way to get good press about it is not by buying golfers. It's actually by inviting any independent journalist, any credible independent journalist, to come to Saudi Arabia and go around the country and write whatever they want, talk to whoever they want, visit wherever they want. And you know what? Some of them are going to write about some of your continuing human rights abuses, the lack of democracy, corruption. They'll write about all those things. But you know what? Any fair-minded journalist who's been going to Saudi Arabia for a long time will also write about some of the very positive changes there around Islam, around freedom to for young people to breathe, basically, around reform of Islam to a less puritanical version in Saudi Arabia. So that's how you get good press. You let independent mm-hmm. journalists come in and write the good, the bad, and the ugly. You know, but what they're doing is just, I think, bad for them and bad for golf. But it's good for a golfer who doesn't really care about any of that, and somebody who's ready to write them $100 million check. Who am I to say? You know, I mean, it's not. I'm just not going to get into that.
Yeah, that message coming from you is a lot more interesting and a lot more compelling than what we're hearing from Brooks Koepka and Patrick Reed.
This is way beyond their capacity to navigate, you know.
Now, you are a dedicated golfer, a golf addict, as you say, and your golf history goes, you are in the Caddy Hall of Fame, Tom.
I'm in the Western Golf Association Caddy Hall of Fame. I put that up there with three Pulitzers.
I would as well as a former looper myself. And I thought that's fascinating. You've caddied in US Open, I believe at Hazeltine.
Yep.
And grew up caddying. And you know what? I grew up caddying as well. And I know a lot of other writers did as well. It's a wealth of stories in the caddy yard. I think still the best storytellers I was ever around were still some of my caddy friends. Or the caddies I looked up to. I wonder if you ever think about, you know, the role that caddying played in your life and in what you do now. Because as a caddy, you have to know how to read people, right? I think you get a good sense for who the phonies are and the good guys are, the good ladies are, you know, when you're carrying their bag. And I think that can translate into, I think it's translating into the rest of my life. I don't know about, what do you think about that?
I think it's very true, Tom. You know, first of all, you know who cheats. You're a caddy. You know the guys who kind of nudge the ball a little bit and kind of look up at you. That's between you and me, you know, kind of thing. Yeah. You know, Jimmy Dunn always tells this story, which I quoted in my last book, that, you know, because he grew up caddying too. And Jimmy's a great golf fanatic. He's the president. I'm a member of Seminole. He's the president of the club. And Jimmy says, you know the guys who at the turn bought you a Coke. You know the guys who bought you a Coke and a hot dog. You know the guys who bought you a Coke, a hamburger, and a chocolate bar. And yeah, you really learn a lot about people in that way. For me, what it really did was when I grew up caddying at this little club called Brookview back in Minneapolis. So there were a lot of small businessmen there, and it really gave. And I listened a lot to their conversations. And it actually introduced me to business, and it gave me an appreciation of small business people, you know, and the challenges of small business people. I wrote about this in my last book because there was a guy, I don't forget his name, was Dave Levy, who belonged to the club. And one day my dad told me that he went bankrupt, and I didn't know what bankrupt was, but I discovered that meant you're out of holes and out of balls. It meant you weren't in the club anymore. And I remember that having a big impact on me, like, wow, you could like be in this club and in this group and playing golf every day. And then one day it could be all gone. You're bankrupt. And so that had a big impact on me. Chichi Rodriguez gave me my first sex education class. When I caddied for him in the US Open, we were on the practice tee one day and I was kind of his straight man. He said, Tommy, I used to give lessons. I said, oh, really, Chichi? He said, but I gave him up. I said, well, why did you give up being a teacher? He said, well, I had this woman and she was a slicer and I turned her into a hooker, and everybody laughed. And I didn't know what a hooker was. I was all 17 and my dad had to explain it to me. So you learn a lot. It made me, because another thing it was, Tom, I was around a lot of adults as a young person. I was around an inordinate number of adults as a young person, because when you're caddying, that's what it is. And I think that helped me grow up a little bit faster.
No doubt about it. I couldn't agree more. How'd you get on? You got Chi-Chi's bag in the US Open. That's pretty good.
In those days, believe it or not, the USGA had a rule that you could not bring a professional caddy to an open because there were amateurs as well, and that would be an unfair advantage. Oh. They later changed that rule. So the way they did it at Hazeltine, each club nominated 4 caddies. I got nominated from my club. And a week before we walked the course, we got a little booklet from Don Warren, who was the head pro at Hazeltine. And then that afternoon, this week before the tournament, they took out a big silver bowl in the dining room at Hazeltine, and they had every player's name folded in the bowl. And you just walked up, pulled the name out, opened it up, and that was your player. Wow. And mine was Chi-Chi. Somebody else's was Tony Jacklin, who won the tournament. Somebody got Sam Snead. Somebody got Arnold Palmer. Somebody got Jack Nicklaus. Yeah, hard to believe, but that's how they did it.
Really hard to believe.
And what's sad is that will never happen again. That no young boy will ever have, or girl will ever have, the experience I had of sticking my hand in that bowl and pulling out the name of a great golfer and having that amazing week.
Why can't we? Oh my God. I know why we can't, but what a tremendous thing. And what a sad thing, like you said, to not have that again. Cause it's just, it's a dream.
Yeah, exactly.
And you've had a really interesting golf life. You know, I don't know anyone else. I've gotten around, Tom, but you know, my first person I met who was a member of the Country Club of Beirut. Is that right? Yeah.
Beirut Golf and Country Club.
Golf and Country Club, of course.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
What's the hang like at Beirut GNCC?
Well, I haven't been there in a while. This was back in the late 1970s. I was a member.
Interesting time to be there.
Yeah, they only had 13 holes. The refugees around Beirut had actually bitten off 5. But there were 13 decent holes. And they had great watermelon. They had a pool. Lots of beautiful Lebanese. And it was great fun. My wife and I used to go out there weekends and we'd play. And there was a Palestinian shooting range that was perpendicular to the driving range. So, you know, you could be out there driving balls and hear gunfire, you know, going basically in the other direction. You weren't near it. But as I said, it's the only course you're really happy to be in a bunker some days.
I would imagine. Yeah. Have there been times, I mean, you've covered some really interesting and challenging topics and even dangerous places. Has there been a time when golf's helped you get a scoop in any of those environments? Doesn't seem, you know, like golf is in the Middle East seem like the most natural fits, but you know, it's a crazy game. It makes, you never know where you're going to find a connection with somebody.
Well, that's a very good, you know, point. You know, I had a very funny experience the other night. I was invited to a dinner that was hosted by Yusuf Al-Ateba, who is the ambassador of the United Arab Emirates to the United States and an old friend. And he gave a dinner as part of the Abraham Accords to honor the Israeli ambassador, Michael Herzog, in Washington. I got invited to his very small dinner. And most unusual, an Arab ambassador giving a dinner for an Israeli ambassador. And they asked me to say a few words when the evening started. And I looked around the room and I said, and there was a bunch of senators there too. And I said, I am the only one in this room who can make this claim. I knew both your fathers. I covered Yusuf's father because he was the UAE oil minister. And I used to cover OPEC. And I covered Michael Herzog's father because he was the president of Israel, his father, when I was the New York Times correspondent there. And he had recently had a heart attack before I had come. And this was in the mid 1980s. And his doctor prescribed for him golf. So there weren't a lot of golfers in the country at the time. He found out that I was one. And so I used to play golf with the president of Israel all the time. When I was the correspondent there, and he was full of information for me because it's an honorary position in Israel. The prime minister is the power authority, and he was always giving me good tips on what was actually going on in the power realm. So I've had, you know, the honor. I played with President Clinton. I played with President Obama. Golf has gotten me into a lot of places it wouldn't have otherwise.
Well, of the heads of state, who's the best?
Obama has definitely got the best game. Obama can pound it. I mean, he can hit it, you know, 280, 290, when he connects, doesn't always connect, but he can pound it. And I was with him. I played with him at Robert Trent Jones about 6 months ago, and he shot 37 from the back tees at RTJ. Now you can also shoot 47 from back there on any given day, but when he's going, he's got a legit game.
Wow, that's fantastic. Now, he's
also an absolute scratch. He's actually a +6 as a trash talker.
Is he?
So, really loves to get into your head, loves to get into your pocket. And a lot of fun to play with.
Wow. What's your handicap? How many strokes are you giving him?
I'm now 8. Just looked the other day, 8.4, 8.5, something like that. Yeah, I'm getting up there. I'm 68 now, so I don't quite have the distance I had before. But I can still get it around.
Well, for someone who does get around as much as you do, that's pretty impressive that you're still keeping it in the single digits.
Yeah.
What would be in your wide range of travels, maybe the craziest place you've ever gotten to tee it up?
Well, I played at the Tehran Golf and Country Club once. Whoa. It also just had 10 or 11 holes. The Revolutionary Guards had taken a bunch of them. I played in Cuba. I played in Moscow. I played in Cameroon. I played in China. Played in Indonesia, of course, that's no big deal. I've played in Cairo. I've played in Dubai. I've played in Israel. I've played in Iran. But Iran probably was the craziest.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yes, I didn't know that there was a golf course, even 11 holes or whatever.
Tehran Golf Club or whatever it was called. And my caddy was the New York Times stringer at the time, and she carried my bag in her black chador.
Did she really?
Yeah. She was a character, lovely woman. And she did it just for the fun of it. But we got a good picture out of it.
Oh, my gosh. And you probably had some interesting pairings at some of these places. Anyone?
There we played by ourselves. Yeah, I don't remember that much about it. But it was a lot of fun.
Well, I know that golf for you is it's got to be, dealing, working in the political sphere. Golf has to be an escape. As it is for all of us, and something of a retreat from our regular lives otherwise. How do you, as someone who works in, as a political commentator and columnist, how do you keep, or do you keep politics out of your golf? Because for me, I do not like the blending of the two. My dad was in the Navy, and he'd have a saying from in the officers' club, you couldn't talk about politics, religion, or the opposite sex. And I try to apply that to my golf as well. We got to talk about something else.
That's a very good, question, Tom. And it's, and sadly, it's become harder and harder, because, on January 6th, I was playing at Congressional, but also watching my phone, which you shouldn't do. And I walked off the six. I told my playing partners on the 16th green, I got to go. Something really big is happening. The same thing actually happened yesterday. I haven't have a column. I write Tuesday nights for Wednesday. And so I had to check my phone and just sort of what was going on. And I saw this this testimony before the January 6th committee. And I realized I had to change my column. So the pro shop, I was playing out at Kaysville, and the pro shop sent a card out. And I had to go into, a private room and update my column. I had to quit after 16 holes. So, I mean, it's everywhere. What's sad to me is that, because I'm with you, when I come to golf, I don't want to talk about politics. I want to talk about politics with my golf friends even. It is my escape. And and I play with, I've got friends who are left, right, and center. So, and the beauty of golf is that, we at Kays Valley, I was walking down the fairway one day. I was playing with my friend Larry Moody, Larry who runs the Bible study on the tour, who's a very close friend of mine. He's a member at Caves. My friend Tom O'Neill and our friend Sammy Eldon, who's a member of Caves, and myself. And we were walking down the fairway, and I said, not a lot of clubs where you can have a foursome representing the basically four of the greatest faiths on the planet. A Christian, a Protestant, a Muslim, and a Jew, all in the same foursome at the same club. So to me, that's the beauty of golf. Brings you together with all kinds of different people. I've played all over the world, never had a bad day. Can't tell you of ever that a pairing I had that, God, that was a terrible afternoon, you know. And that's the way I want to keep it. But we live in an age now where everything is politics. And even if it isn't on the course, you go into the locker room and someone's saying something and I'm with you. It has no place on the course, off the course. Once you come in that gate, whatever it is, whether it's your local muni, you know, or the country club in Brookline, you know, to me, you should leave your politics at the door.
Well said. And Tom, I know you've got to run. You're on Anderson Cooper tonight, as you are. Folks have caught you on any number of news programs. And I just want to leave you with a question about what, you know, aside from golf, what you know, your work as a columnist and someone who has, you know, is paid to have an opinion and to make argument in 2022. I really admire that because I wonder about, you know, how hard is it to do that anymore? If I have a take on a golf course that people don't like, I get destroyed.
Right.
And you're talking about real things, you know, that people are passionate about it to the point of, you know, they'll do crazy things when they don't like your opinion. So I'm just wondering, what is it like to be a columnist in 2022? And can we still have discourse? Is it worth arguing anymore?
Yeah, those are good questions. You know, it's, first of all, it's really noisy. If you sit where I sit, you're the object of a lot of attention. In my case, because I'm pretty much a centrist, you know, both sides, they want you, and if they can't have you, they get mad at you, you know, so there's that. I'm not in a friend growth industry. And so I can take the heat. I've been doing this for a long time, and I can dish it out and I can take it. And I believe people have the right to come back at you, you know, but you know, my motto is, if you don't go, you don't know. It's to really do your homework, build your opinion on solid foundations, admit when you're wrong, you know, and march on. I have said, you know, I do not look at Twitter. I use Twitter as a broadcast platform, but I don't even know what Twitter looks like, actually. I mean, I've seen screenshots of it, but I have no Facebook. I've never looked at Facebook, and I've never smoked a cigarette. And my plan is actually to die saying all three. I let just enough of the world in to know what's going on, but not so much that I get overwhelmed by it. You know. And so if you're tweeting about me, y'all have a good time. But I ain't there, you know, and, that's one way I try to stay sane. But the most important thing, about golf and life is, I tell young journalists, is to be a good listener, for two reasons. One is what you learn when you listen. That's important. All the stories I got wrong were because I was talking when I should have been listening. But secondly is what you say when you listen, because listening is a sign of respect. And it's amazing what people will actually let you say to them or ask them if they think you respect them. Mm-hmm. If they don't think you respect them, you can't tell them the sun is shining. But when people think you respect them, it's amazing what doors and emotions and truths that can open up. So that's always been my motto, you know. I'm a little Jewish kid from Minnesota who wanted to cover the Arab Muslim world. I've done it for 40 years. People will tell you, I think if I can say one immodest thing is I'm one of the most closely followed writers in the Arab Muslim world, a little Jewish kid from Minnesota. And my secret is not because I tell them what they want to hear. And my secret is that I really try to be a good listener and show everybody respect.
Very well said. Because it's the thing as a writer that you wonder, are there enough open minds out there for anything that I'm putting down to make a difference? And I love what you had to say, that if you do respect someone, maybe they will open their mind to you in 2022, which is a crazy idea, right?
Yeah.
Tom, thank you so much for your time. I hope we get to, hey, let's play some golf. I'm up in Philly, not too far away.
Absolutely. I'll remember that.